young people in particular give me hope. There's a huge amount of energy and entrepreneurialism there that we should listen to and actually support more than anything, instead of trying to think that we can come up with a solution for them.
That was Yanti Sarepto. And if she gets her energy and optimism from young people, well, that's only fitting. Yanti is president and CEO of Save the Children, the global organization that served more than 144 million children last year alone. I'm Alain Verveer, and this is Seneca's 100 Women to Hear. We are bringing you 100 of the world's most inspiring and history-making women you need to hear. Yanti leads a renowned nonprofit committing to giving children a healthy start, the opportunity to learn, and to protect them from harm. Earlier this month, Save the Children's annual Global Childhood Report came out. It paints a picture of the state of the world's children and how they're doing in the time of COVID. Yanti refers to this situation as a hidden crisis, but she also sees a willingness among people to step up and take action. Listen and learn why Yanti Sarepto is one of Seneca's 100 Women to Hear. I'm so delighted to be here today with Yanti Sarepto. She is the president and CEO of Save the Children. And I think this is a really timely conversation about children in our own country, children around the world, and the work of Save the Children. Yanti, you are from the Netherlands. You've worked in the private sector for many years. You've been based literally all over the world, from Indonesia to the UK and Singapore. Can you share some of your background with us, what your career journey was like, what made you the female leader you are today, the head of a renowned organization that serves 144 million children last year alone?
Thanks, Milan, and thank you for having me, and I'm really delighted actually to meet you as well. So, yes, I was born and raised in the Netherlands, but my father was from Indonesia. So he essentially migrated to the Netherlands as a young student and then met my mother and stayed on to have his family. But I do think that that dual history made me very appreciative of the fact that the Netherlands is a fantastic country to be a child and to raise a family, but that there were also other countries. And it also instilled in me a certain liking of adventure. So I figured out pretty young that I wanted to make sure that I was able to work abroad and was also able to leave the Netherlands, because it's a wonderful country, but it's also quite a small country. So I really picked a subject of my studies when I went to university, and after that a company and an industry which I felt was going to get me out of the country and was going to allow me to work abroad. So I picked to study economics because I like numbers, and I thought it would allow me to work internationally. And then I was accepted at Unilever, which I knew was a multinational and would clearly give me an opportunity for an international career. So that was really what drove it. And then after a number of years there in the consumer goods industry, 15, 16 years or so, I thought, this is great. And I loved it, and I truly enjoyed my time at Unilever. It's a fantastic company. But I also thought, I can't be doing this. I can't be sort of selling shampoo or frozen food for the rest of my life. There must be something else I can do to make sure that inequalities that are so clear, to see, that I can have an impact on that. And that's when I started to really look into the independent and the nonprofit sector. And then I got sort of lucky that when I was working in Indonesia, still in consumer goods, I was asked by a search firm to look at the opportunity with Save the Children, and that sort of sealed it for me.
Well, I can understand how it sealed it for you. And just the name Save the Children, I think it's something that we all want to be associated with because it's so consequential. So we've heard the name, but we may not always know exactly what the organization does. Could you clarify that for us today?
Sure. Save the Children was founded in 1919, actually, by a phenomenal woman, visionary Eglantine Jebb, in the United Kingdom, who thought after World War I that it was not right that children behind enemy lines, right, children in Germany and Austria were starving because they were essentially children of the party that lost the war. So she didn't think it was right. She started to campaign. She started to advocate with the UK government to do something about it. And of course, people told her that she was a traitor. She was even arrested famously for handing out leaflets with starving children in Trafalgar Square. And that essentially was the beginning of Save the Children. Currently, so fast forward more than 100 years, Save the Children is now based in over 100 countries in the world, including in the United States. And we really focus on giving children a healthy start in life, an opportunity to learn and to profit from a good quality education and also be protected from harm. And we particularly look in every country where the most vulnerable, most marginalized groups of children are, because we know that if we get it right for them, we make it better for all children.
That's so right. If you get it right for those in the most difficulties, the others will do well as well. So I'm very familiar with Save the Children really being there in a time of humanitarian crises, when the children are, along with the women, the most likely to be suffering the greatest. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like in those crises environments and what Save the Children comes in and does, and perhaps what some of those situations are?
The good thing about us is that we usually are already in countries when a crisis hits, and we've been there usually for decades. So the relationships there with local communities, local partners, government partners, as well as civil society, is already strong. And that allows us quite often to pivot really quickly when disaster strikes. And quite often it is in an area where we already have a presence with teams on the ground. And those are, you know, natural disasters, of course, are often get the most attention, in particular if they're big, like some of the hurricanes we've seen here in the United States, but, you know, in particular things like the Asian tsunami in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
But people today, sadly, of course, most of our humanitarian work is actually in protracted crises like Yemen, Syria, and South Sudan, where there's and those are usually man-made disasters, conflict, war, leading to displacement. And that's where we've been throughout the conflict, trying to maintain access to populations in need and also helping, in particular, children, making sure that we try to shield them from the biggest risks.
And those are such heart-wrenching situations. The photos alone are so descriptive of what's happening to kids who are, on no fault of their own, caught up in these disastrous situations. I've often wondered, do you use mostly personnel from those places, or do a lot of people come in through SAVE's work from elsewhere?
We still have a little bit of both. I think you'll see the needle shift more and more to having people there already. We have 25,000 staff worldwide. The vast, vast majority are directly from the countries and even the communities where we have our work. And a good example is in one of the more recent earthquakes and tsunamis in Indonesia and in Sulawesi in 2017, I think. At that time, the Indonesian government actually didn't allow non-Indonesians to come in. And it was quite remarkable to us that although I think normally we would have surged in a few people from the outside, we managed to set up a very strong team on the ground within 48 hours. And we essentially ran that whole response in Sulawesi, with some help from of course, our staff in Jakarta. But we ran it with local, national, fantastic Indonesian staff, and we mounted a very effective response. So the days of airplanes full of Brits and Americans and Swedes and Dutch people, I think, to some extent, is really over. And I think that is essentially a good thing.
Well, and I think especially where there are restrictions put in place, as we often hear about, of not letting humanitarian workers in, quote unquote, to be able to have people on the ground who are in country to respond is obviously something that is a great resource.
That's right. And I think a lot of the communities on the ground, not even Save the Children staff, but shopkeepers and local officials are usually the ones really on the front line. So to help them be ready, and we do quite a lot of work there in terms of training and preparedness training, so that communities themselves are more resilient when disaster strikes. Because of course, in these areas, particularly natural disasters, we sort of know that they come around.
Yeah. And speaking of these crises, whether they're national disasters or happening in war zones, we are now the world over going through this pandemic that has taken such a toll. I understand that you weren't in the job even 3 months as the new head of Save the Children when COVID-19 hit. What does it take to lead a global organization through such difficult, challenging, uncertain times?
I did say to the team then, this is what Save the Children trains for. We are an organization that does well in a crisis. So in that, of course, it was new that it was everywhere in everybody's community and homes. And of course, we had everybody also needing to homeschool their kids, take care of elderly parents or family members, et cetera, and being concerned about that. But so in that sense, of course, the scale of it was different. But to pivot and to immediately have sort of mechanisms and processes in place where people go like, okay, there's a crisis. We know what to do. We go out. We start to look at our programmatic interventions. What needs to happen? Oh, we need to go remote schooling. We've done that before. So can we now we've never done it before at this scale, but we sort of know what works and also what the issues are going to be when children are out of school for long periods of time, because we've responded to epidemics in the past. And we were also lucky that we had on staff people who were actually working on pandemic preparedness, ironically, in particular for African countries where there were weak healthcare systems.
Now, I know from a lot of the work that I have done as well that COVID-19 has not just had disproportionate impacts on certain segments of our populations, but really exposed existing inequalities in very significant ways. And for children, that goes from healthcare and education to the situation of the families that they find themselves in, the safety of the children. I have been tracking some of the work on girls in school that when the lockdowns came and the schools closed, many of them are in desperate situations and big question mark, will they ever go back? But, you know, victims of potential trafficking and abuse, et cetera. I know that you've put out an annual childhood report, which I've read myself over the years, but that this year is really focused on the impact of COVID-19 on children. Tell us a little bit about that impact from the perspective of Save the Children.
Yeah, and that is really what our aim was when we did the report. And we also, preceding it, we did a global survey to really talk to the children and the young people in our programmatic in the communities where we work to understand from them firsthand what their experience had been. And we did that in over 50 countries, I think, and with thousands of children. So what we see, of course, to your point, Milan, is really coming out. And that, of course, should really, you know, that gives us grave concerns. So we're seeing in terms of health and survival mechanism, particularly for young children, if routine and basic interventions are disrupted or stopped altogether, from immunization to basic, you know, prenatal and postnatal care, that really puts under 5 mortality numbers at risk. Of course, under 5 mortality numbers had been dropping and dropping and have halved, right, over the last 20 years, as you well know.
Right. Great progress.
Fantastic progress. And now we're really worried that we'll see either a stalling or a plateauing of that number of 6 million kids dying every year before the age of 5 of preventable causes, but we might actually see an increase because kids will die from, you know, malaria, measles, and pneumonia because there is no oxygen, there will be no vaccination, and the local healthcare clinic has either closed or has no capacity to deal with it. So survival, immediate concerns are around health and survival. Then, to your point, over a billion kids are out of school. And we know also from the Ebola crisis, when kids were out of school for 10 to 11 months in those three countries only in West Africa, we know that many of those, particularly girls or children with disabilities or incredibly poor children, they didn't go back to school at all, even when schools reopened. So that worries us greatly that those kids will never go back because they'll be married off or they'll be put to work because the family needs them to work because they don't have any money. When schools close, we saw that also here in the United States, which for a country as wealthy as the United States, of course, is shocking, that kids don't have access to their one nutritious meal a day when the school closes. So we think that hundreds of millions of kids are actually now more food insecure because their schools are not closing, are closed. And then to your earlier point about harm and violence, we see increased violence. Children are cooped up at home. Quite often there's domestic violence. There's more pressure on the family because of economic consequences and concerns there. And the school and the teachers often provide a very useful extra pair of eyes on the well-being of kids. And that now is also lost. So we'll see more kids being harmed, essentially. And I think when we talk to our partners in countries, also in the United States, that operate hotlines for that, they tell us that they see a huge increase in calls, and they see a huge increase, particularly in calls from minors, children under 18. And that's a shocking. And they told me here in the United States that they'd never seen that kind of an increase of that age cohort. And that's hugely concerning. We also think that there's around 2.5 million girls at risk of being married extra, of being married off before the age of 18, on top of the 12 million girls per year that get married off. And then lastly, perhaps, and that, of course, is underpinning some of these things, is that people in extreme poverty will be on the increase. The informal sector in particular is hard hit in Africa and also in Asia. And again, there are no social protection mechanisms that there have been even in the United States and certainly in Europe. And those children will certainly be at risk of never going back to school, but also of gaps in their well-being and survival widened as often happens.
You know, it's so sad to listen to you because this is so extensive and touching so many children around the world. And to think so much progress has been made on health, on getting children into school, and now much of that may be lost. And it's going to be critical. I would imagine you would agree that when we face that opportunity to recover and build back better, hopefully, that we really have to have a lens of the state of the children applied to those opportunities to begin to recover.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's certainly what we're asking for, particularly with the new Biden administration, of course, and across the world with governments where we think we should and could step up, certainly their overseas, their development assistance.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear will be back after this short break.
You mentioned the United States, particularly in terms of the state of children here. You gave us a couple of examples already. And I know that the Childhood Report came out for the first time also with giving a state-by-state ranking about how kids are faring in our country, the best and the worst situations during the pandemic. What have you found briefly in terms of the impact on children across the United States?
Yeah, and actually in 2019, we did our first report that really did a deep dive in the United States at a county by county level. We looked at over 2,000 counties then across the states.
Oh my!
To look at the situation for kids. And at the time, we already called it the land of inopportunity because we really felt that there were strong inequalities coming through, particularly for kids in rural communities. Now, last year, for this year's report, we looked at a year of pandemic and what are the impacts on children, particularly in all of those states. And of course, what you see there, a real, you know, hidden crisis unfolding as it is globally, it is also in the United States. Millions more kids are hungry, missing out on learning, and forced into poverty. And those equity gaps are really along geographic, income, and racial ethnic lines. So kids who are already poor, live in rural areas, and are from communities of color are more likely to go hungry and have access to remote learning or even internet access, full stop. And the poorest families are struggling the most.
Are there best and worst states? Do you actually rank the states?
We have ranked the states. The best states for children have been Minnesota, Utah, Washington, New Hampshire, and North Dakota. And the worst states for kids have been Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, New Mexico, and Alabama. And those best and worst actually don't always correlate with states with number of COVID cases in those states.
But just listening to them, you know, I've been involved with Georgetown's ranking of the best and worst in terms of the disparate impacts on women. Mm. And there's a large correlation with the disparate impacts on children,
right,
or disproportionate impacts on children. Very interesting. You mentioned that race obviously plays a role because there is so much racial inequity. What about gender playing a role in the COVID impacts on children? Is there a difference there?
We certainly see that globally. I think in our own childhood report, when we were looking at the data, the short answer is it depends on the state and sometimes even on the county. We do see worldwide girls face, of course, higher rates of violence, poverty, and discrimination. Women are really at the front line of this pandemic, right? They make up 70% of the workforce, of the healthcare workforce in the United States as well as globally. Women and girls are at increased risk of gender-based violence. Women are more at risk of not returning to work when the childcare industry is not able to provide or is going or also facing increased risk of bankruptcy. So we're seeing that impact on women in the United States, yes. In terms of girls and boys, it depends very much on which states you are. We do see the racial ethnic lines across the states by and large. Black families are twice as likely to lack access to food, twice as likely to struggle with housing costs, less likely to have tools for remote learning.
I know that you cater to all children, boys and girls. But can you give us a sense of some of the programs that are targeted to girls? Because many of them live on the margins of their societies.
That's right. And as we discussed earlier, you know, getting it right for girls and other marginalized groups really helps our interventions be better for everybody, including the boys or the children who are in the advantage groups, if you like. So we try to make sure that every time we design an intervention, we look at it with a gender lens to make sure it is right for girls or other marginalized groups in that particular context. And in order to make sure that that intervention actually delivers outcomes for all the children who can benefit from the program. Now, we then also do some specific interventions on girls, for instance, on education or adolescent reproductive health, or on changing laws to prevent girls from being married off before the age of 18, which of course is a much sort of more of an advocacy and policy play with various governments to encourage them to have the laws to begin with, and then also help them figure out how you implement these kinds of policies, because of course that is then where the rubber meets the road. Another example is that in Jordan, you know, when you look at refugee girls in particular, who are most vulnerable, we work with, you know, fantastic corporate partners like P&G to really provide education and life skills workshops to girls and young women to make sure that they understand their rights and that they become actually their own advocates and campaigners to help their families see that it doesn't make sense to not finish their education, that they don't want to get married before they're ready and when they choose, and that they really want to continue to learn.
Yeah, and child marriage really does snuff out the future of a girl.
That's right.
And it's wonderful that both SAVE and your private sector partners like P&G are engaged in this work, because it really matters so much. So you've been talking about some of these very severe, troubling impacts on kids around the world and in the United States. And I wonder, what is your sense? Is this a tougher time than ever to be a child?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So pre-COVID, I would have said this is probably the best time to be a child, looking at all the indicators that we talked about earlier, that where we have made so much progress, more girls in school than ever, fewer children dying than ever, etc. Now, of course, we see some of that progress under threat or being rolled back. So that's a concern. And of course, we're continuously, we talk often about the trifecta of a COVID pandemic, a continued and increased conflict, and of course, climate change. And these three things really come together in certain areas where we'll see more displacement, a weaker infrastructure, healthcare systems, social protection systems, and then children are always going to be bearing the brunt of that impact. And they are at least empowered to do something about it. They can't vote, mostly. So often they're overlooked, of course, in these crises. So that is a concern. So we're probably more concerned. We're definitely more concerned now than we were a year ago about these things that conspire to come together, both in the immediate term, but also in the long run.
I read something about the great, great progress we collectively have made in cutting poverty rates, just dramatic progress in many ways over the last decade plus. And then the punchline to the study was, but all of that or much of that can be erased because of what's happened over the last several months with the pandemic. So there are a lot of worries out there. And in the midst of doing the hard work that you and Save the Children does, what makes you optimistic, Jante? What keeps you going?
Well, I think if you work in this line of business, as you know, Milan, you have to be an optimist, right? Because otherwise, you're not going to last very long. So what does make me really optimistic is actually the resilience of young people and young leaders. Even though we're not traveling, I still have the privilege and luxury of speaking to children in our, across the world, and young people who have really stepped up. They step up and speak out on climate change. They step up and are empowered to talk about early child marriage. They want to have access. They want to be digital natives, and feel that access to technology is essentially a basic human right for them. So that gives me hope, because I do think there is a huge energy there, and an awakening. And I do think people are listening now more than ever. That's the flip side, of course, of the pandemic. Also, people in very advantaged situations, all of a sudden, I think, got an empathy bump to say, oh, this is what it means if you lose choices, if you lose a certain amount of freedom, however small compared to what other people are going through, if you lose your income, or if you lose, the ability to do as you please and to go where you please. So I do think that visibility of the inequities that were built in before COVID, the fact that children are hungry, even in a country like the United States, the fact that girls are more at risk, it is coming out more, and it's harder for people to ignore it. And there's definitely, when I speak to our supporters, they feel that they have to, step up and take action and be loyal to the cause and the mission. So that gives me hope, but young people in particular give me hope. There's a huge amount of energy and entrepreneurialism there that we should listen to and actually support more than anything, instead of trying to think that we can come up with a solution for them.
Well, speaking of the word support, I'm sure that our listeners want to engage, would like to engage in some way. How can they learn more about Save the Children or help with the future of children everywhere? What's the best that they can do?
That's a great question, because we definitely need support. Children need supporters now more than ever. So I would say three easy things. Learn and savethechildren.org. There you can learn a lot about our work, the issues for kids in the United States as well as around the world. So I would really encourage people to go there. Share if you're so inclined, if you're compelled with our work. Share it on your social media, with your networks. Talk to your family and friends about it. Advocate on our behalf. Write to your congressmen and women. Ask them about their policies in your state, if that is what is concerning or interesting you. What do they say about early child education or the childcare industry? What do they say about supporting kids in Yemen or on the southern border? And then lastly, if you're in a position to financially support us, please consider also donating at that same website, savethechildren.org.
Well, and it's so important because the state of children needs to be improved, especially in these very difficult times. And children are all about our future. You know, I once heard, I think it was that the Maasai's in Africa, the tribe, doesn't ask when they meet someone, how are you? Their question always is, and how are the children?
That's exactly right.
And I think that's so profound in many ways, because the state of children should be important to each and every one of us. So thank you so much, Yanti Sirypto, for what you do every day, and most especially for the hard work that the Save the Children staff and volunteers do all over the world. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your experiences.
Thank you very much, Milan. It was a real pleasure.
It's good to know the world's children have such a powerful advocate in Yanti Sirypto and Save the Children. Here are three things that stuck with me from today's conversation. First is the crucial need to focus on children who are the most vulnerable, wherever they are on the planet. As Yanti says, if we get it right for them, we can make things better for all children. Second, we need to recognize and deal with the setbacks brought on by the pandemic. The children who are going hungry because their schools have closed, the girls at risk of child marriage, the youngsters subjected to violence or being sent off to work. We can make a difference for them through Save the Children. Finally, let's borrow Yanti's attitude of optimism. The energy and hope she gets from children can be the fuel we all need as we build a better tomorrow for all young people. Tune in next Tuesday to hear about our next featured woman and discover why she's one of Seneca's 100 Women to Hear.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear is a collaboration between the Seneca Women Podcast Network and iHeartRadio, with support from founding partner P&G. Have a great day.